over. Like zombies, we go through the motions of living entities, but our belief that we have choice, free will, a separate self, and even consciousness amounts to a reassuring story that we zombies tell around the campfire to keep warm. Akin to the complexity theory of mind, the zombie theory holds that consciousness is a byproduct of the brain's quadrillion neural connections. Build a supercomputer with just as many connections, and it will be as seemingly conscious as a human being. The fatal flaw in the zombie hypothesis. Two fatal errors come to mind. Leaving aside the preposterousness of the claim that human beings aren't conscious, which smacks of mischief rather than serious thinking. The first flaw is creativity. Human beings are capable of practically infinite acts of invention, art, insight, philosophy, and discovery that can't be reduced to fixed cell functions. Second, the zombie argument is self-contradictory, because the people who espouse it, being zombies, have no way to show that their notions are trustworthy. It's like having a stranger come up to you saying, "I'm going to tell you all about reality, but first, you need to know that I'm not real." Why your brain doesn't like the Beatles. It's easier to kill a vampire with a stake through the heart than to dispel the assumption that the brain, a physical object, has the power to create the mind. But at least we've seen the fatal flaws in current theories of brain and mind. Dismantling a bad idea, however, isn't the same as finding a better one. We can unfold a better idea through Paul McCartney's beautiful singing of a Beatles classic, "Let It Be." Does your brain appreciate the song? Or does your mind? On the brain side of the argument, neuroscientists can pinpoint some specific brain processes when "Let It Be" enters the ear canal as sound vibrations. Researchers at McGill University in Toronto hooked up subjects to electrodes that measured their brain activity as they listened to music. As one would predict, music creates its own pattern of response compared with non-musical sounds. Raw input that reaches the auditory center in the cortex gets scattered into specific locations where rhythm, tempo, melody, tone, and other qualities are separately processed in a matter of milliseconds. The prefrontal cortex even compares the music you are hearing now to music you expect to hear from past experience. By comparing the two, your brain can be challenged by something it never expected to hear. And further, this can be a delightful surprise, or a distasteful one. The research also shows that the brain gets hardwired in childhood, according to what system of music it's exposed to. A Chinese baby's brain develops specific connections that respond to Chinese harmony, thus leading to its enjoyment. A baby born in the West, exposed to Western harmonies, is hardwired to enjoy that system rather than the Chinese. Finally, the researchers could take a musical performance and gradually change it via computer software to see if the brain notices any difference. Can you tell the real Paul McCartney from the best synthesized version? It depends. As the music becomes more mechanical and less personal, the brain often doesn't notice any difference until the change is glaringly obvious. This might explain tin ears and, at the other extreme, a professional musician's subtle ability to detect the finer points of musical style. Different wiring leads to different levels of appreciation. The research on music and the brain has become quite sophisticated. Yet we'd argue that this whole scheme for looking at music is wrong-headed and will yield no answers that get near the truth. When brain research is medically useful, as in treating Parkinson's disease, for example, or aiding in the recovery of stroke victims, the following factors pertain. A brain function has gone awry in some organic way. The impaired function can be isolated. The impaired function can be observed. The mechanics of correcting the impaired function are well understood. When a stroke victim is wheeled into the ER, a brain scan localizes the area of the blood, and the bleeding is stopped using drugs or surgery. Thus, all the benefits of treating the brain as a damaged thing are fulfilled. Medical science can look into brain functions with ever-increasing accuracy, allowing surgeons to do their work more finely, and leading to drugs whose action is more localized and specific. However, where music is concerned, almost none of the deciding factors are in place. No brain function has gone awry. The brain functions that produce music are complex and mysteriously connected. The actual transformation of noise signals into meaningful music cannot be observed physically. There is no explanation for why the higher brain evolved to invent and appreciate music. Therefore, no cure exists for people who are totally indifferent to music. It's not a malady. Is this just a matter of neuroscience being behind the curve? Would a heap of money and more research grants yield better answers? Not if the whole model is fundamentally wrong. The brain somehow produces music out of raw physical data, vibrations of air molecules. Everybody agrees on that. A radio also produces music. And yet it would be absurd to say that the two are equal. A radio is a machine working through fixed, predetermined processes. However much it may appear to be similar, the human brain can do anything it wants with musical signals, including tuning them out entirely. Everything depends upon what the mind wants. The brain's mechanisms exist for the mind's use. When a person likes or dislikes a piece of music, the mind makes that decision, not the pleasure-pain centers in the brain. When a composer gets inspired, his mind provides the inspiration, not his neurons. How can one be so sure? The answer would fill a book, but let's divide it into three compartments. 1. Determinism is wrong. If the brain is hardwired from childhood to hear Chinese music in China, Indian music in India, Japanese music in Japan, and so on, why do all these countries currently have Western-style symphony orchestras, almost entirely filled with native-born musicians, playing Western classical music? You can't call the brain hardwired when connections can be changed at will. Determinism looks good in the schematics of a neurological network, but it breaks down in real life. By analogy, it's as if brain researchers are trying to tell us that house wiring can change from AC to DC current on its own. That's the equivalent of a brain's deciding to like Chinese music. Only the mind can create such a shift. If a dozen interrelated areas of the brain combine to process music, as opposed to processing the sound of a buzzsaw or wind in the trees, how does the raw input know where to go beforehand? The auditory center receives all raw data in the same way, along the same channels from the inner ear. Yet the data from a piano goes straight into musical processing. This implies that the auditory center already knows which sounds are a buzzsaw and which sounds are music. But it doesn't. We see where each signal goes. We don't know why. Let's roll back the clock to a time when you heard "Let It Be" for the first time. The prefrontal lobes compare new music with a person's expectations from the past. This enables new music to surprise and delight us by defying our expectations. But there are times when new music creates just the opposite reaction in the same listener. You may not be in the mood for jazz one day and yet love it the next. You may be bored by Ella Fitzgerald, only to discover later that you think she's wonderful. In other words, musical response is subject to unpredictable changes. No mechanical system can explain this variability, and reducing it to random neural signals only pushes the problem deeper. The preset chemistry in a neuron can't be expected to produce one response and its exact opposite. 2. biology isn't enough. Music exposes why some human behavior makes no sense biologically or in terms of evolution. We love music because we love it, not because our ancestors made more and better babies if their genes carried a response to music. Searching for the evolutionary need for music puts the cart before the horse. Instead of requiring music as a survival mechanism, we enjoy surviving thanks to music, because our minds delight in it. By any reasonable Darwinian perspective, human hearing should have favored the keenest possible sensitivity so that our ancestors could hear a lion 100 yards away instead of 10 or 20. Not getting eaten is a good way to survive. Or, like the Arctic fox, we should be able to hear a mouse move under 2 feet of snow. More food in winter leads to better survival. But we didn't evolve with that kind of acuity. Instead, we evolved the totally useless, from the point of view of survival, yet joy-enhancing love of music. Music is personal, whimsical, and unpredictable. That's not a flaw that science needs to correct or explain. It's part of human nature. On one famous occasion, enemy soldiers walked out of the trenches in World War I to sing Christmas carols together. Which is more human, that behavior, or fighting to the death in a senseless war? Both, in fact. Human nature, like music, is inexplicable in its complexity. Something new was created spontaneously when Let It Be emerged. New styles arise out of sheer inspiration. But let's say that one could build a supercomputer and input every possible musical chord and phrase. There would be more of these than atoms in the universe, by the way. And let's program the computer to develop all possible musical styles. In time, it would produce the music of Beethoven purely at random. But that's the very thing that invalidates the computer brain model. Because Beethoven didn't spend 1,000,000 hours tapping out random combinations until a new style emerged. Instead, a musical genius was born. A single musical mind who listened to the old style, creatively grew beyond it, and changed classical music forever. 3. Your brain isn't listening to the Beatles. You are. The mind-brain problem, also called the hard problem, has proved so impossible because putting the brain first was a mistake. Neurons don't listen to music. We do. Therefore, why examine neurons as the key to music or to any experience? Even the most basic elements of consciousness are absent from the brain. It has no idea that it exists. If you stuck a knife into it, the brain feels no pain. It has no preference for the Beatles or Led Zeppelin. In short, mind cannot be explained by using any object or thing, even the glorious object that is our brain. You wouldn't ask your car radio whether it preferred the Beatles or Led Zeppelin. You wouldn't expect your laptop to cry, "Ow," if you stuck a knife into it. It's time to face facts. There is no physical process that turns air vibrations into music. Inside the brain, there is no sound. It is a completely silent environment. Let It Be, with its qualities of sweetness, religious feeling, pleasure, and all the rest, isn't a product of brain circuitry. It is built from the infinite potential of the mind that gets processed by our nervous system. Music cannot be found in a radio, a piano, a violin, or in a collection of neurons sending chemical and electrical signals to one another. If we take these facts seriously, the mind assumes a status no machine can duplicate. This status is what we call consciousness. Consciousness cannot be fabricated, which makes it possible to reinvent the universe, not as a place where consciousness somehow got cobbled together on lucky planet Earth, 2/3 of the way out from the center of a galaxy called the Milky Way, but as a place where consciousness is everywhere. There are many fence-sitters in physics who will concede that nature acts in mind-like ways, but they cannot swallow the proposition that the universe behaves exactly like a mind. Schrödinger had accepted this impasse almost a century ago, when he declared that it makes no sense to subdivide consciousness. If it exists at all, it exists everywhere, and we would add, at all times. Therefore, when someone says that consciousness is solely a property of the human brain, they are guilty of special pleading. The brain is doing nothing special that isn't happening throughout the universe. Why is the human mind creative? Because the cosmos is creative. Why did the human mind evolve? Because evolution is built into the fabric of reality itself. Why do our lives have meaning? Because nature proceeds with a drive toward purpose and truth. We promise to answer the why questions that crop up everywhere in daily life. And now we hold the key to all of them. Cosmic mind drives every event and gives it a purpose. At this point, we've covered 9 cosmic mysteries that lead to 2 conclusions. First, the best answers being offered by science aren't good enough. The "we're almost there" camp wears an optimistic mask, but behind the mask is confusion and deflating confidence. Much less popular is the "we've barely begun to find the answers" camp, but its position holds the overwhelming amount of evidence on its side. It may even be true today that this view is held by a majority of researchers and theorists. The second conclusion is that reality is trying to tell us something new. It's saying that the cosmos needs to be redefined. All the taboo words rejected by physicalism, creativity, intelligence, purpose, meaning, have gained a new lease on life. In fact, we have shown that they are the cornerstone of a conscious universe, expressly created for the evolution of the human mind. Reality is the ultimate judge. There is no court of appeals that ranks above it. If reality is pointing the way to a new universe, it would be pointless to resist. Keeping faith with "one day we will know all the answers" does not get us closer to the goal of tackling the nature of reality, here and now.